Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, you're listening to the Anthropology channel of New Books Network. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm your host, Yadong Li, a PhD student in anthropology at Tulane University. Obeying rules and submitting to demands or requirements of others have been a critical feature of our daily life. Without compliance and obedience, there can be no orderly functioning of social life. This is especially true for people across the world who have experienced a variety of restrictions on their daily activities as governments, health officials, and international organizations have grappled with the COVID-19 pandemic. The edited volume we will discuss today is about compliance, about how to understand the practices and reasons of compliance in different socio-cultural contexts. Ultimately, this volume provides us with an alternative approach going beyond the dichotomous model of repression and resistance. I'm very glad to invite one of the editors of the volume, Dr. Will Rollison, to talk about this insightful new book. So welcome to New Books in Anthropology, Will.
Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, thank you for joining us. So the new book we will discuss today, Compliance, Cultures and Networks of Accommodation, is published by Birkenberg Books in 2023. Dr. Will Rollison is a senior lecturer in anthropology at Brunel University, London. His research has focused mainly on Papua New Guinea and Rwanda. He wrote articles about youth, sports, and politics. Another editor of the volume, who unfortunately is not here today, is Professor Eric Hirsch. Professor Hirsch is professor in anthropology also at Brunel University, London, and his research also focuses on Melanesian anthropology. So, well, I'm very excited to have this opportunity to chat about this new volume. But before our conversation, could you please introduce yourself to our audience? What brought you to anthropology and what are your research interests?
Thank you very much. Well, as you say, I'm a senior lecturer at Brunel University, London, where actually I share an office with Eric. So, we sit quite close together and we've done quite a lot of work together. How did I come to anthropology? I think like quite a lot of anthropologists, kind of by accident, I started doing... When I was doing my undergraduate at the London School of Economics, I started doing a degree in political science, but I couldn't do the maths. And I was doing an elective in anthropology. So I was like, oh, this is cool. And then I was one of those students who never quite, gets round to getting a proper career. So I ended up working in universities rather than having a real job. So that's how I got to it. I mean, what am I interested in? So as you say, I've done field research in southeastern Papua New Guinea and in Kigali in Rwanda. And what I've been interested in those projects have been things about power, and particularly power in relation to appearances and to performance. And that was where the things about sport came in. And also latterly, and this is where this book sort of jumps off, in issues about compliance and sorts of relationships in which people come to do what somebody else wants them to do without necessarily having to be compelled or coerced or even directly asked to do things. So, that's where I come from, essentially.
Okay, thank you for sharing all this amazing information. And also, I'm also not good at mathematics at all, so I can totally understand. So about the book, compliance is a theme both very familiar and strange to us, whether it's in everyday life or in anthropology particularly. So specifically, it's hard to find the right words to describe or explain compliance, particularly about its significance, because we all know it's important in our social life, but it's hard to explain why it is important. So as a volume about compliance, what do you want to accomplish through this book, or what is the shared focus of all the contributions of this edited volume?
Okay, so I suppose one place to start is to think about the book provocatively, if you like. So what we wanted to do was to get our contributors to think about compliance as the opposite of resistance, if you like. So anthropologists, like, on the whole, have liked, since I suppose the late 1970s, have liked talking about resistance. And that's meant that non-resistant types of relationships sometimes have been sort of de-emphasized in a way in certain areas of scholarship. So we wanted to get people thinking about what would it actually mean to focus in on those relationships of non-resistance. But also we wanted to try and get at and to unravel some of the implications of doing that. You know, what would it mean theoretically, actually, to bring relations of compliance into focus and really to problematize compliance? So, I mean, concretely, the book's got chapters about farming in Rwanda and corporate compliance in Europe and the USA, tax compliance in Scandinavia and Bolivia, medical compliance in South Africa, carbon offsetting, health and safety on building sites in the UK, and immigration in Italy. So we've got quite a broad range of sort of substantive topics. But what we'd ask contributors to do, and what we'd ask them to think about, were the ways in which people do as they're told, or do as they're expected to do, or how they imagine that they're expected to act. How they, you know, how do they follow rules? How do they follow expectations? And we wanted to think about the things that make those relationships work, right? So what the infrastructures might be that needed to be in place for people to do as they were expected to do, and how that was also related to the persons or to the political subjects who are involved, and what that would tell us about the collectivities in which these relationships take place. So what we were really trying to do then was to unpack compliance as a sort of optic for thinking about social life more generally.
Thank you. I can totally agree with you that there is always a space between repression and resistance. So basically, we need to give more attention to how people strategically, but also unconsciously, negotiate their everyday life, going beyond this kind of dichotomy. It's fantastic to witness this effort to, you know, explore this space. So the operation of social life requires compliance, especially in times of crisis. I know this book was produced during the COVID-19 pandemic, but specifically, what prompted you and the contributors to have a volume about compliance? What was the story behind it, and what was the idea originally from?
Okay, so I mean, I should say that the core of this book was originally published as a special issue of Journal of Legal Anthropology. We have the editor of that journal, Namala Halstead, to thank for inviting us to put that together. So that was part of the impetus, was just being given space. And she basically said, you know, why don't you write us a special issue and think of something to do? So, I mean, that was part of the prompt. The reason I wanted to think about compliance and the impetus to edit the book really came from my previous research, as I say, in Papua New Guinea, and especially in Rwanda. And I should say that, as you said at the start, the other editor, Eric Hirsch, isn't here today. And the reason essentially that I'm talking to you rather than him is that this volume is essentially my fault. Whereas the other book that we've edited together, The Melanesian World, was really his baby. So, you know, if it was that, he'd be talking to you. So anyway, a lot of this came from this previous research. And in both places, I'd gotten quite interested in the ways people try to organize life in such a way that compulsion and coercion weren't really necessary. Even though those two contexts across Papua New Guinea and Rwanda are really very, very different. In Papua New Guinea, where I worked, there was no way. I mean, this was a small island, which is quite a long way from anywhere else. There's no police presence and so on. And so there was really no way at all that one person could force somebody else to do something. So getting them to cooperate depended on, you know, things like everyday kinds of exchange, kinship type obligations, making sure especially that social life conformed to certain visible patterns so that people, you know, knew what was going on and what was expected of them. So Rwanda's a very different context. And in Rwanda, the state is at least potentially very intrusive and actually very dangerous potentially for ordinary people. But at the same time, there was something quite similar going on in the sense that people were keen to do as they were told or to be seen to do as they were told, or at least what they thought was being demanded of them by local and also by national leaders. You know, there's this joke in Rwanda that if the president woke up one morning and said he didn't like oranges, then tomorrow, you know, he'll wake up in a country that doesn't have any oranges in it. You know, that's the sort of the feel of the place. And actually, people were very often trying to get out ahead of what was being demanded of them and do things that they thought that they were going to be asked to do later on. So there was this whole idea of, you know, sort of getting ahead of the state all the time, a sort of defensive gesture. And for me, that was something that really stood out, because lots and lots of Rwandan studies is actually articulated in terms of resistance. And James Scott's work is a sort of huge touchstone in Rwandan studies. But that wasn't really helping me much to think about the material that I had. So I got explicitly interested in compliance on the back of that Rwandan research. And actually, it's the center of the book that I published. You'll have to correct me. I think I published it in 2020. But, you know, I'm an old man. I don't remember that kind of thing. It came out with Lexington. It's called Motorbike People. And a lot of the ideas underlying this volume, and of course, they changed as we were working on it and developed. But a lot of the ideas that are underlying this volume, I was sort of working out for myself in that monograph. And this book, in a sense, was almost like a fishing expedition. I was like, we've got these ideas. Now I've got these ideas. What do other people think about it? And sort of trying to get response and to draw them out and to broaden them. As a basis for thinking about the relations between compliance and resistance. And the implications of those ideas for what we can say about politics and social life more generally.
Thank you so much. Thank you for all these clarifications and also the background story of how this idea come from. Basically, it's super interesting. So I think it's time for us to focus on the keyword compliance itself. So the most significant keyword in the book, obviously, is compliance. So a simple question is, what are we talking about when we talk about compliance? What do you mean by this term specifically?
Right. So I get this right in the context of the volume, I'm actually going to quote here. And in the volume, in the introduction to the volume, we define compliance as that set of means by which actors strive to accommodate themselves to others in their collective life. Now, that's deliberately a very broad definition. And it's broad partly because we wanted to let the concept work as a heuristic, essentially, rather than hemming it in. And in formulating compliance in that way, we've looked at a range of meanings for comply. And one of my favorites, which came out when we were looking at everything that, you know, compliance might mean, and also I think one of the most revealing, is actually an archaic usage where to comply could mean to weave or to braid. Now, I think that that's really useful as a reading of compliance because it draws attention to compliance as something which is constructive. The activity of getting on with other people, of accommodating to others as being something which is formative, constitutive, something which essentially weaves social life together. Now, I think that that constructive status for compliance is important because, as I said, all too often anthropologists want to talk about resistance as being, you know, the opposite of compliance, which tends to mean that when people do as they're told, you know, when they just get on with stuff and they get on with getting on with other people, that actually isn't very interesting, or it seems not to be very interesting. So the notion of compliance that we're trying to establish in the book, trying to explore, at least in the book, is aimed at drawing attention to the ways in which these sorts of everyday accommodations are basic to collective life. So that's basically what we're trying to get at. We're trying to get at that activity of getting on, of accommodating.
Thank you very much. And in the following discussion, we can see how anthropologists actually apply this definition of everyday accommodation to specific sociocultural contexts. So, but I think prior to the birth of social anthropologies, many social theorists had their source on compliance, and all these sources represented by two big names in social science and humanities. The first one is Thomas Hobbes, and the second one is John Milton. So can you briefly introduce their theories of compliance, and what are their legacies in the anthropology of compliance?
Right. So we discuss Milton and Hobbes in our introduction, and I think these two characters are interesting. And that's partly because they're working at almost exactly the same time, in the mid-17th century and around the English Civil War. So at exactly that point where the state in its Westphalian form is first being theorized in Western philosophy, right? So essentially, both of them are thinking about the proper relationship between this new kind of state and the people who are subject to it. And they agree about some things, but they tend to think about this issue from opposite directions. So both of them think of politics as being about a relationship between a sovereign power and individual political subjects. But Hobbes, of course, famously thinks that the independence of those subjects is a problem because it can only lead to conflict, whereas Milton is much more inclined to think that individuality and the freedom of the subject is fundamentally good. So the imposition of sovereign power is unjust. It's a problem, right? But, you know, Milton's much more of a sort of libertarian kind of thinker. Now, in terms of legacy, the way that we've thought this and the way that we deal with it in the introduction is to use that opposition, which I think is right there at the basis of European political thought, to talk about the way that anthropologists think of and value collective life as collective life, right? So Durkheim was, you know, in a way, a big fan of Hobbes, and he lectured on his thought. And especially the Hobbesian idea of collective life as a necessity, as a kind of bulwark against chaos, makes its way into his work and then via that into structural functionalism and British social anthropology in a big way. So there's this one tradition in anthropology which is basically Hobbesian and is interested in social cohesion and assumes that that's a good thing. But then on the other hand, there's this other tradition which is more recent, is associated with feminism, neo-Marxism, anti-colonial kinds of scholarship that's essentially Miltonian in the sense that it's suspicious of collectivity, right? And that suspicion takes the form of a critique of patriarchy, or more broadly of collective life as taking the form of a system of domination, right? So the point I think that we would make is that anthropology always seems to find itself stuck between these alternatives, which are essentially the same sorts of alternatives which are laid down by Hobbes and Milton back in the 1640s. I mean, admittedly, you know, all of the good ideas of European philosophy come from the 17th century, right? But, you know, it's still interesting that that pattern persists, I think.
Definitely. I think rather than just representing their personal individual souls, actually they represent two lines of souls in regards of compliance. One is more like Durkheimian, like more collective and to treat it as a necessity. And the other one is more Foucauldian. It's to add a discussion with more elements about power and domination and resistance. So basically, I think their legacies are still very strong in today's social research about compliance and accommodation. So basically, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say possibly. I mean, I don't think I would identify Milton with Foucault, really. I mean, actually, I would say that, you know, almost all the good ideas of European philosophy come out of the 17th century, except the ones you can trace to Nietzsche. And I think that actually that's interesting, because one of the things which Milton and Hobbes have in common is the idea that power, and power is something that you use against violence. Whereas that sort of Nietzschean tradition, and the reason that Nietzsche is reaching back to Homeric heroes is because actually he wants to talk about the violence which is implicit in power, right? Which in some ways I would put that as a slightly different kind of tradition to the one that sort of I would put Hobbes and Milton in, but I'm splitting hairs. Sorry, go on.
Sure. So basically I want to talk more about the methodological difficulty of studying compliance. So why is it so hard for anthropologists to treat compliance as a serious and important issue in their research?
Right. Well, I mean, again, this is a huge question, right? And I'm not necessarily qualified to answer it, but the way in which we've answered it in this introduction is through thinking about Milton and Hobbes, right? And if you kind of accept that division in anthropology, where you can choose to represent collective life in a Hobbesian form, where collectivity is good and you know, social cohesion is good, and the alternative is something that, you know, might be anarchic or might be violent, that sort of older British social anthropological tradition, and the other tradition, which is skeptical of power, is skeptical of collectivity, and is by implication, therefore, basically a sort of liberal individualistic tradition in anthropology, right? Now, the problem that both of those traditions is going to have is that those two traditions actually already embed an idea about what compliance is and what its value is going to be. So right from the get-go, compliance is actually kind of embedded in the analysis as a pre-theoretical commitment, right? Hobbes thinks compliance is good, right? Durkheim thinks compliance is good. It's actually not a question that you can answer. What you're looking at is the effects of certain kinds of compliance. But the same thing applies on the other side, right? If you're super interested in resistance, and you think that, you know, people should be resisting state power or what have you, then that also embeds this notion that compliance is problematic, right? And that it's somehow the sort of opposite of agency or the opposite of politically effective action. So the difficulty of bringing compliance into focus is really, I think, about the way that anthropologists have tended to conceive the relationship between political subjects and the collectivities that they're part of, right? So it's really about, the problem is about the pre-theoretical commitments that anthropology has to particular ideas about, yeah, subject and collectivity and power.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this clarification. So despite all this definitional and methodological difficulty, so how can we study compliance anthropologically, or treating compliance as an ethnographic object? I remember you posted three ethnographic approaches towards the study of compliance anthropology. So could you please briefly introduce your thoughts and questions to us?
I don't think that there's a trick to studying anything ethnographically. I don't think there's anything special that needs to be done. If there's a trick, then it's to avoid closing the question of the relationships that make collective life work, right? So not to fall into that sort of Hobbes-Milton trap of defining the players, the possible relationships between them, and the means by which they can act on one another, right? So the way that we've tried to set up compliance as an ethnographic problem is actually to raise the question of who the actors might be, how they might be constituted, the actors of compliance, what the media are through which they comply, right? What sorts of things are enabling them to comply? What's carrying that relationship of compliance? And then what the collective life actually is, which is established between these particular kinds of actors or subjects in the ways in which they're relating to one another. That's the sort of intellectual setup, as it were, that we're bringing to the book.
Okay, thank you very much. And So after discussing the question about compliance, I want to go back to the design of the book. So for any edited volume, I'm always curious about how and why editors frame the book in particular ways. So could you let us know why do you structure the volume in the current way? So what is your aims and goals in your design, basically?
Well, I mean, as an editor, I'm always intrigued looking back at books I've edited to try and remember why it was that I structured it in the way that I did. I think in this case, I mean, I don't think there are very many interesting answers to this. not that it's not an interesting question. I think that what we did was we tried to move from accounts of straightforwardly political compliance through compliance around taxation and medicine, which are areas where compliance has this particular specialized meaning in the practices in question, right? So, you know, tax compliance or regulatory compliance, you know, treatment compliance, these kinds of things. These are actually words, you know, compliance is a word which is in use in those fields. And then from there, we moved into more, I guess you'd say, everyday or unremarked forms of compliance at the end. I mean, there is one very important chapter. I mean, obviously all the chapters are important, but one of the chapters is very important is Steve Sampson's chapter about corporate ethics, which in some ways is a little bit of an outlier. And Steve has been writing about corporate compliance for years. And, you know, he's a great expert. And his chapter is really covering, from a corporate point of view, those uses of compliance, which are very much in that sort of specialized business compliance sort of mode, which in a way is, you know, not being specialists in business compliance that we're skirting. So he's doing quite a lot of heavy lifting in the volume, sort of covering that angle, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And so let's discuss more about how to study compliance ethnographically and based on the concrete examples provided by different contributors of the book. So the first ethnographic question you pose about compliance is who the actors of compliance are. So I'm pretty sure that all of us are to a greater or lesser extent actors of compliance in our life. So can you give us some examples from the volume to show why the actor of compliance matter in analytical perspective and also how to identify the actors of compliance, basically?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, of course. I mean, everyone complies all the time, right? So I think the question is about the relationships in which that or as which that compliance takes shape. So I think one really good example is in Anna Berglund's chapter in the book. She's telling us a story about a community of small farmers or peasants in rural Rwanda. So this community, like the rest of the country, is being affected in her chapter by agricultural modernization policies. And that means that what they grow and how they grow it is controlled by the Ministry of Agriculture. And that policy creates, and you know, there's lots of literature on this, all sorts of problems for rural Rwandans around food security and income. Right, because they're not being allowed to grow the things that they actually eat. They're having to grow things for market. And of course, if you've read James Scott, or I mean, a lot of the Rwandan studies material, which draws on Scott, you'd expect for there to be a lot of resistance. But what Berglund shows really well is that there isn't. And actually, the people involved are rather keen to get on board. Now, one way of interpreting that would be to say, well, you know, the Rwandan state's very active and it's very intrusive. It's coercive. So obviously these people feel themselves compelled to do what they're told, right? And that's sort of the easy cut by way of a talk about power to thinking about how this compliance happens. But what Berglund shows is that the farmers aren't actually coerced. They want to comply. And they want to comply because they don't want to be seen as poor people, or as Rwandans tend to put it, as backward people, you know, people with a backward mentality. Those backward mentality. You can't see this if you've not got the video, but they're in air quotes, right? So the point is that if you want to talk about an actor or an agent of compliance, it's no good positing some kind of human universal or appealing to law or to the state in general or something like that, right? What leads people into compliance, like these Rwandans, is specific. It's not just the particular context in which that compliance happens, but the way in which people imagine themselves as people, right? The way they value themselves in relation to others. And in that, this case that Berglund's talking about, that means not just that political compliance in this community is a function of how people imagine themselves. It's also going to make a difference to what they think they're complying with, right? Because it's not just a law or a policy, but it's the way that that law and policy takes shape for them as something meaningful, as something effective, and something that is forming their aspirations and their visions of who they might be in the future. So, I mean, that's what we're trying to get at, I think, with the idea of, you know, who the actors of compliance are.
Thank you very much. I think, yeah, indeed, we should treat compliance as a more interactive relation, interactive social practices, rather than just a one-way action, a one-way policy like something. And the second ethnographic question you pose about compliance, or we could also say the second dimension of analyzing compliance, requires researchers to pay more attention to medium and agencies through which relations of compliance operate. So in short, what do you mean by medium and agency of compliance, and how can we achieve this goal by focusing on this medium and agencies?
Right. So for me, this is another call to specify and to be suspicious. So it's really about picking away, as you say, at that assumption that compliance is necessarily extracted by force or the threat of force on one hand, or I guess by self-interest on the other. And I'd hasten to add, this is not in the slightest an original idea, right? And you only have to read Foucault's famous essay on governmentality to see that. And the whole point that Foucault is making there is that the construction of a political subject who can be manipulated through their interests, right, is something which is quite recent in European history and the result of a great deal of more or less deliberate political work, which originates around utilitarianism in the early 19th century. And in just the same way, Tim Mitchell was arguing back in the 1990s that for someone to be susceptible to threats of force, they first had to be put into a cultural position where those threats were imaginable, right? So we're not making any huge claim for originality here. So what we're really trying to do is to go beyond saying liberal political subjectivity and the media it operates in are historically specific, right? And we're trying to ask the question, if liberal political subjectivity is specific, then how else does subjection work, right? How else are people brought to comply with power? And even more broadly, you know, what has to be in place for people to comply, and not just in the non-West, but also within the global North. And in the volume, to get specific, I think you can see this kind of argument coming through really clearly in Sarah Winkler-Reed's essay, which is about health and safety regulations on building sites. And the point in that chapter is that there's been a big shift in the UK construction industry from its being relatively poorly regulated and very unsafe before about the 1990s to being relatively heavily regulated now. So you've got this shift where site managers nowadays are really committed to safety. And they're making real efforts to change a kind of macho culture, right, where you know, being safe, wearing hard hats is for wimps. So the point that Winkler-Reed is making is that that shift isn't really caused by the regulation. And it's certainly not about punishment. Rather, it's about kinship, right? And actually a sort of rearrangement of masculine work on building sites in terms of household obligations and you know, people's commitments to one another. So that the best argument for getting people to practice safely at work is that if you get hurt, you're going to let your family down. So the medium for compliance in that sense isn't just about law, right? It's not about coercion. It's not about police or regulation or what have you. But it's actually a construction of gender and specifically masculine forms of work in the context of households and things. And that's then the medium, if you like, through which these compliant relationships are operating.
Okay, so it's definitely not a A to B relation, but A through some mechanisms to B, and B also have some mechanism to A, so it's basically a more complicated process. Could I understand in this way?
Yeah, no, exactly. And we've borrowed the idea of media essentially from the tour, right? And the idea of a mediator as being something that stands between two things and makes a difference. And makes a difference in a way which is material on one hand, but is also in some ways unpredictable, right? So, I mean, there's another example in the book, I mean, that I could draw on if you'd like. I mean, Jonathan Stadler's chapter is about medical compliance in South Africa. And it kind of also draws this out really nicely. He's talking about treatment for latent tuberculosis in a black township in Johannesburg. And it's a context where medics tend to think of their patients as people who lie and are untrustworthy and are not likely to follow medical protocols. So they think of their patients as being non-compliant and awkward people, right? So one way of fixing that is to make sure that the patients are always supervised when they're taking their medication. But that's, of course, very onerous and it's time-consuming for everybody involved. So instead, the clinic that he's studying starts using this smart pill box that has medications in it that can alert a patient when they need to take medication and can also record when the medication has been taken. Now, that piece of technology, which is a kind of sort of panopticon that you can put in your pocket, right? I mean, it's a very sort of Foucauldian device, is part of the media of compliance, right? I mean, it's what is carrying that relationship. That's its whole purpose. But what Stadler's doing is actually really interesting because he's looking beyond that. And this is, again, about the practical way, I suppose, in which you can ethnographically capture what these media of compliance are. He's looking beyond that sort of panoptic function of this device. And what he finds is that the patients who are using this box and finding that it helps them to stick to their treatment regimes, they don't feel watched or monitored. Actually, for them, the smart pill boxes embody a kind of care. Right. Partly the kind of care and attention that they're not really used to getting in the healthcare system, but also the sorts of intergenerational care that are represented by not dying of tuberculosis. Right. So that you're there for your family and you can bring up your kids and so on. So in that case, and I think this is something that comes out through all of the chapters, paying attention to the way that compliance works, right, to its, you know, what we call its media or its agencies, is really just about listening and not stopping the analysis when you come across something which fits into received models of politics, if you like.
Absolutely. And thank you very much for bringing this example of medical compliance into our discussion. I am very impressed by this chapter, well reading, and I think it's definitely very helpful for our audience to understand your opinion about the actor and also the medium and agency of compliance. And about the third ethnographic question, you mentioned several times in the introduction that collective life as a whole can be specified in terms of the practice of compliance. So I'm very curious about, what is the specific difference between this opinion and the theory of Thomas Hobbes about compliance as a necessary sacrifice for social life? So again, could you please give us some examples from the volume to show this difference?
Okay, so I actually think the difference is quite huge and quite fundamental in some ways. So Hobbes actually starts off his political analysis, as I understand it anyway, from the idea that life can be thought of in terms of motion, right? That it consists in movements towards things that you like and away from things that you don't like. And it's that model of the human that ultimately gives him the idea of compliance as a sacrifice and a submission to the sovereign as being self-interested, because without a state, anyone can move towards the things that they want with violence, right? They encroach on one another. And that violence can't end because getting what you want makes you powerful. And Hobbes thinks of power as something that other people will want. And so the more you get, the more you're going to find yourself under attack, right? So the peace that the state brings is all about giving people the time and space to enjoy what they have by only allowing them to encroach on one another in political and economic way. Now, what's obvious in that analysis, and this is something that McPherson analyzes so beautifully in his book, The Political Theory of Possessive Individualism, is that it relies on a particular construction of the political subject and the kinds of media through which people relate to one another, right? And McPherson argues, and actually this is something that in hindsight, I kind of wish we'd dealt with directly in the introduction. McPherson argues that the whole political scene in Hobbes is tied to the development of private property, especially in land and mercantile capitalism in the 17th century. So the point is that in order to work, Hobbes's political theory already has to know who the subject of politics is and the ways and means of that politics, right? So, you know, to have this notion of the collective as this collective sacrifice, you need to have this subject and you need to have the idea of violence and the idea of encroachment. So that issue about the constitution of collective life, for me, and in contradistinction to Hobbes, follows from what we've already been talking about in terms of who complies, what kind of actor we're looking at, and how the compliance happens, the media and agencies of compliance, right? So for Hobbes and also for Milton and for Locke and that whole tradition of liberal thought, what social life looks like and what it should look like follows directly from a definition of the political subject and the ways that subjects can relate to others and the way that they're related to authority. Now, that's fine, right? I mean, that's a particular construction of collective life, and it's a very influential one. But if, as we've asked the authors in this volume to do, you start to question the nature of the political subject, the sorts of relations that subject can enter into, then you're going to find out that the whole form of the collectivity is going to be different, right? I mean, this is essentially the basic observation that any theory of power has also to be a theory of the subject and a theory of relationships, right? I mean, that's kind of what's going on here. So in this volume, I think you can see this happening in a really interesting way in what are in some ways the most conventional chapters about compliance, which are the ones about taxes. So there are two big chapters about taxes. One of them is by Lotte Bjerk and Larsen and Benedicta Brugge, who write about attempts to apply the same OECD guidelines on tax compliance for multinational corporations in both Norway and Sweden. Right? So it's a comparative thing. And these are efforts to make government oversight of corporate tax affairs less adversarial, more cooperative, and therefore more efficient. Now, you'd think, given that this is Norway and Sweden, that they're really similar places where the outcomes of doing essentially the same kind of thing would align very closely. But actually, what they find is that the outcomes are completely different. The Norwegian business community, you know, this sort of corporate, they follow this policy through one particular corporation. And they think the whole thing's a bit of a waste of time, and they're sort of confused about what on earth the tax office is trying to do. Whereas in Sweden, the Swedish business community gets terribly angry about it, and the whole thing is totally rejected. And what Larsen and Brugger are showing, I think, is that the respective tax authorities in Norway and Sweden, in trying to change the way that they do corporate taxation, are actually posing a really fundamental question, which is, what's a state, right? And how does it relate to its citizens? So, you know, what's a citizen as well? And how does this relationship work? So these policies, in a way, are actually addressing and in practice trying to change, right, what a corporation is, how it's going to relate to government, and you know, what are the means by which that's going to happen. So it's really sketching a vision of the collective there. And then you've got, as a sort of side to that, is Miranda Shield Johansson's paper, which is about taxation in Bolivia. And the people that she's dealing with in urban Bolivia are more interested in using taxation as a way of making claims to land and other kinds of property, because their logic is that if you've been taxed for it, then it must belong to you, in a context where, you know, property holding is sometimes a bit questionable. And it's a story about the same kinds of institutions, right? Taxes, government tax offices, these kinds of things, which are formatted in very, very similar ways, but again, with a totally different set of outcomes. And it's not just because they're in a different cultural context, I think, but it's because the Bolivians she's working with want the whole relationship of taxation to be something different and to do different work on the state and in a collective life that's also completely different and made different, I'd argue, by the way that they relate to it. So obviously the state and taxation and you know, corporations and taxpayers and so on aren't everything that you might find in a collectivity, right? I mean, you want to think much more broadly than that. But in a sense, that doesn't really matter. The point is that what I think is going on in these cases is that states and citizens, taxpayers, are hazarding specifications of collective life, right? They're saying, you know, what are we actually? And they're working out what that collective is in the practice of negotiating about tax. So quite unlike in Hobbes's theory, those specifications of who, you know, who there is and how they might relate and what's going to come of it are actually up for grabs, right? They're not fixed. They're not set at the beginning. And as a result of that, I think they become ethnographically interesting in a way that, you know, the sort of liberal subject as it comes down to us from people like Hobbes, in a sense, isn't, because we already know what it is.
Thank you so much. I think our discussion has already shown how complex social interaction actually is and how a focus on compliance can help us, especially for political anthropologists, to complicate the whole picture of social interactions through a focus on compliance. So basically, I want to talk about more practical issue about the study of compliance. So I think compliance seen from an anthropological perspective actually offers us a very effective engagement with the crisis of the environment, politics, and health, which marked our contemporary era. So how can studying compliance help us cope with contemporary crisis?
So this is something that we sort of pick up in the introduction and also in the afterword to the book. I think what we had in mind when we were thinking about this was Latour's argument in Facing Gaia and also in Down to Earth, where what he's doing is he's explicitly linking together environmental and political crises. And I think these are sort of big crises, right? You know, the rise of the populist, right? And the climate crisis. Now, the reason I think that the ideas about compliance can help to think through these issues is because the way in which the climate crisis and the crisis of populism seem to demand that we think differently about what we're complying with. Right. And this is something that Stefan Dalsgaard, I won't go into huge detail about this because I think that I would be straining what Stefan is trying to say in his paper. But I think this is something that I get from Stefan Dalsgaard's paper, a chapter rather, about carbon offsetting. Right. So, I mean, the point that Latour is making, pars through the notion of compliance, is that in this time of ecological crisis, we need to comply not just with political regimes, but with a climatic regime. Right. So and one of the drivers of right-wing politics also, from Latour's point of view at least, is the demand that we kind of ignore that and we get back to something else, something older, something more basic, something purer. You know, there's make America great again, you know, that kind of politics, which is an effort, again, to force compliance with an old order, an order so old that really today it's a fantasy, compliance with a myth. So the problem for contemporary politics for Latour is to bring itself into line, to accommodate itself to the right things, right? So first of all, you know, how do you go about complying with an ecosphere which is going to kill you, right? How do you make that into a politics? Now, that's the question that Latour is raising, right? And then to formulate the kinds of politics that will make those accommodations real. And I think that those are problems of, you know, those are exactly the kinds of problems of compliance that we want to raise, right? In order to have that kind of politics, you have to rethink what the actors of compliance are. Who is complying? What are they complying with? And how are they doing it? You know, those are the sort of fundamental questions that speak to, yeah, this contemporary time of crisis that we find ourselves in.
Absolutely. I think for me, when reading the book, I'm thinking about crisis time is very special because it actually makes useless the traditional dichotomous model of repression and resistance because we actually do not have a specific actor of resistance and repression, but we do have the new actor and new mechanism about compliance. So this is what I think your additive volume is very important for us to understand our current situation and how to deal with it. So focuses on a more specific crisis in our most recent time. This is a volume produced during the COVID-19 pandemic, which of course is one of the most influential crises in human beings' recent history. So I think it's appropriate to talk about the connection between compliance and the COVID-19. So why is understanding compliance helpful for us to face the aftermath of this pandemic?
Well, I'm not sure about aftermath, but one of the things that we were very, very interested in while the pandemic was happening was the sort of spontaneous compliance with restrictions that at least you saw. And again, I don't know about the US context, but in the UK, you ended up with a lot of spontaneous compliance. We had a government that was dragging its feet, didn't want to bring in restrictions, was very worried about doing that. And what you saw was a population which was very much out ahead of the government, right, in terms of staying home and wearing masks and social distancing and all of these, you know, things that later on became compulsory. And I think what's interesting about that, and it's the same kind of point, I think, as I'd make about the climate crisis, is what was interesting was that compliance wasn't directly shaped by regulation, right? Because often it was ahead of it. What it was actually being shaped by in some ways was by what the virus actually was, right? And what people understood it to be. So one of the things, and this is saying, I think that Eric came up with rather than me, but it was a line that I liked, was that, you know, the compliance in the COVID, in that moment of the pandemic, actually made politics happen in the air, right? The politics was literally in the air. And that what you were doing when you were wearing a mask was not complying with a rule, but actually accommodating yourself to an airborne aerosolized virus, right? It was happening within your social relations. You didn't want to make people sick. And the air then was a salient medium of that relationship. And it was something that you had to deal with. So people were behaving in compliance with one another's needs. They were also complying with rules, but then they were also, as I say, dealing with this virus and how they understood the virus moved and replicated. I mean, I say that, you know, I'm not sure about aftermath, because I think that moment of spontaneous compliance has gone, right? That this was something which was actually really interesting, but it was just that moment, right? And again, I don't know so much about the US, but, you know, lots of people have gone back and they're saying, oh, you know, this was terrible and all the rest of it. But I do think that moment in the pandemic, for all that it was very difficult, and obviously it was very tragic for lots of people and you know, had horrific outcomes for very many people, is also a moment of hope. Because it's this demonstration that I suppose we, you know, in Western Europe, we probably haven't had since the Second World War, that social life can be radically changed. And it's that kind of change to adapt and to accommodate, not to what you want, right? And not to what you like, but to what appears to be necessary that's at stake, right? In, you know, the ecological crisis and the climate crisis, in all of these kinds of things. Because, you know, really and truly, it's no good standing around crying about your inalienable rights as a Lockean subject when everything's on fire, right? I mean, that doesn't help. And that's not an argument for trampling on people's rights, but it is an argument for having the conversations about, you know, what rights are going to fit, what rights are going to work in a world which is configured as it is, rather than saying, oh, my rights, and setting everything on fire, which is kind of the alternative, as far as I can see.
Definitely. I totally agree with you that I maybe choose a wrong word, a bad choice of word, because if this crisis is ongoing, it's definitely not an aftermath. So yeah, definitely. Thank you for this reminder. And so, although far from a heated or classic topic in anthropology, I think you have already mentioned in the book that compliance has received increasing attention from anthropologists and from social theorists. So if a reader or our audience hopes to know more about the intellectual outcomes in this field, Can you recommend some works from a perspective which might be helpful for us to understand compliance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in terms of the sort of the things which brought me here and which, you know, in lots of ways are much, you know, are really, really, really good books. I mean, I've got a couple of things which are about Rwanda specifically, which are very interesting and take shape within the context of the Rwandan genocide of 1994. So Scott Strauss's book, The Order of Genocide, and Leanne Fuji's book, Killing Neighbors, are both very much about ways in which government policies get enacted, or what look like government policies get enacted in the absence of policy. Right. The Rwandan genocide is really interesting because it's an event which, you know, there's really no evidence was ever planned, and yet somehow looks as though it should be planned. And what's brilliant about both of these books is that they really, really trace out how that works, right, and what the social relations are which are involved in replicating and spreading that kind of thing. In terms of post-genocide things, Andrea Perdikova's Making a Bomlet is a great book and does similar work in the post-genocide context. There's a brilliant article by Nicola Palmer called Reexamining Resistance in Post-Genocide Rwanda, which is in the Journal of Eastern African Studies. I believe that's 2014. And it's very unfashionable and very old. But J.J. Mackay's The Premise of Inequality is also a really interesting book, which is very much about compliance. I mean, those were the kinds of sort of Rwandan sources that I use now. I think are right there in terms of talking about compliance. And of course, there's Saba Mahmoud, who is also interested. I mean, she doesn't talk about compliance as such in the terms that we've talked about it, but of course, she's very interested in forms of political agency which are not resistant, right? In contexts where, as a liberal scholar, you might think they should be resistant. So, I mean, her Politics of Piety is a fantastic book. More tangentially, another book which I found really useful and really influential is Ryan Schram's Harvests, Feasts and Graves, which is actually a book about the same region of southeastern Papua New Guinea where I did my doctoral fieldwork. What's interesting about that book is that he's using ethnomethodology and particularly Garfinkel to talk about the way in which compliance, but with the way in which people line up, essentially, right? The way in which they orchestrate observable kinds of activity that people can join in with and understand what's going on. So I think that that's theoretically a very, very, very interesting book. Other things which I used or I found really useful thinking about this issue, Holbrad and Peterson's edited volume, Times of Security, which we make a lot of use of in the framing the introduction, but it's not directly about compliance, but you can easily read it as a book about compliance. And actually there's a lot of literature which falls into that category of, you know, things you can read as books, which are really interesting books, a really interesting piece about compliance. I mean, you could of course go to Marcel Mauss's Essay on the Gift, right? Which is fundamentally and actually really interesting, right? A book about compliance, because you can only have obligation, right? Obligation only makes any sense if you also think about compliance. I mean, another thing which I found really useful thinking these issues through is John Law, and especially his essay about Portuguese navigation and the way that you can construct ships and systems of navigation so that, you know, you can comply with the west coast of Africa and make it round to India. So, I mean, there's not that much, I think, out there. I mean, the Rwandan stuff, that, you know, not that much that I know anyway, which is directly, absolutely on the topic of compliance. But there's actually a lot of stuff in anthropology that I think you can read in this way. And, you know, where, you know, thinking in those terms might be interesting.
Fascinating. I think it will be definitely very helpful for our audience to read all these ethnographies in parallel with the works of Thomas Hobbes and also James Scott, and to rethink about the traditional model of resistance and repression, and to add more ethnographic texture to this kind of interaction in social life. So I think it's a very fruitful conversation. And as we are approaching the end of today's podcast, my last question is, what are you working on now? And what is your plan for your future projects? Are they still related to compliance, or you want to explore more topics?
Well, at the moment, having talked about COVID-19, I'm pursuing what was really a COVID project. So it was a remote project. I started doing some work on plane crashes and air accident reports, which are actually, this is related to work about compliance, because some of the material that I'm dealing with is about, regulation and how regulation shapes what happens in these kinds of events. But I'm also interested in the idea of human factors in engineering and the way in which the notion of human factors constitutes subjects of particular kinds and, formats the sorts of narratives that can be told in the context of disaster. And finally, I'm interested in air crashes as narrative events in themselves. I mean, your question, of course, assumes that I'm an organized scholar who has a plan, which is not necessarily true. So, I mean, it's early days. I've written a bit on that, but we'll see how it develops. I'm on research leave, on the sabbatical at the moment, so I'm working on that stuff, and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for sharing all this with us. And to be honest, by the way, I do think football is something really about compliance. Of course, there is some power and domination and resistance on the pitch and off the pitch. But on the pitch, particularly, it's all the footballers, they actually, apply a logic of a compliance of accommodation, immediate accommodation to other players. And so the game could continue and, all the things could operate. So basically, it's very interesting because I read your articles and books about football, and I'm a football fan. And so I'm thinking about the connection between compliance and football. I'm very sorry if it's a little bit absurd or something.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that you're exactly right. And actually, I think that games in general are a really interesting place for thinking these kinds of things through. And I mean, there's David Graeber wrote a little bit, I think, about games. I mean, he was more interested in games as the construction of a kind of reality. But again, actually, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. We're talking about compliance, right? Exactly as you say. You don't have to be compelled all the time. The referee isn't blowing his whistle all the time.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's very interesting to see this possible connection. So Will, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for coming to our podcast today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, the pleasure is all mine. So in this podcast, we've discussed compliance, cultures, and networks of accommodation, an edited volume published in 2023. This volume provides insights from anthropologists around the world about the importance of compliance, how to understand compliance from an anthropological perspective, and how human beings may live both collectively and hopefully during times of a crisis through strategically practicing compliance. Thank you for listening to New Books in Anthropology, and we will see you next time.